Last week on Freakonomics Radio, we started looking at whether it's really true that Scandinavia is the happiest place on earth.
Yeah, I definitely am happier.
So it's about togetherness, it's about pleasure, it's about warmth.
I regularly forget to lock car and or house. I do leave my children outside to sleep.
We learned why even economists are getting on the happiness train and de-emphasizing traditional measures like GDP.
My God, let's get serious about the quality of our lives and stop this nonsense.
And we learned about one of the most common explanations for the high rates of happiness in Denmark.
So it's pronounced hygge.
This week, what if all that hygge just isn't happening for you?
If everybody around you feels that life is great, then that could create a stronger contrast, and maybe you start to blame yourself.
And how do Denmark and its neighbors feel about sharing their happiness, especially with immigrants?
Scandinavia has, yeah, we love our social democracy, but it's just for us.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I was recently in Copenhagen speaking with Mike Viking. Seriously, his real name, Mike Viking, who is CEO of the Happiness Research Institute. I'd been hearing about all the factors that make Denmark and the other Nordic countries rank so high on the UN's World Happiness Report: the generous healthcare and childcare and education benefits, the strong levels of social trust, and the hygge. It was all sounding a bit too good to be true. Wouldn't you think that more governments around the world would look at the Scandinavian model and say, wow, they are thriving economically and they're thriving on a happiness and life satisfaction level? Let's just do what they're doing. Why do you think it hasn't happened even more?
The price tag. So I think that the tax level is what scares politicians. But I do sense a larger and larger interest. I get visits on a weekly basis, especially from South Korea. We do see a lot of interest in trying to understand what is it that is working so well in the Nordic countries that seems to have a positive impact on people's lives.
Now, one thing that those countries do, which is unimaginable in the U.S. context as of today, they tax themselves and tax themselves.
That is the Columbia University economist Jeff Sachs, who's an editor of the World Happiness Report.
And they end up paying, 45 to 50% of national income.
A lot of people are paying around 50%.
And that's the recent British transplant, Helen Russell. She moved to Denmark a few years ago when her husband got a job there.
I'd say most things, if you're doing your grocery shop, it's maybe 20% more. Goods and services are very expensive. Life is more expensive. There is not very much extra when you've paid for everything.
But the data show that high taxes and prices are generally considered worthwhile.
9 out of 10 Danes are happily paying their taxes. There is an acknowledgement that we collectively invest in the public good, and that is fed back to people in terms of quality of life.
There is something about the taxes. When you're paying that much tax, you have to trust that this is all going to be worth it. And like life, you know, we're all trapped by something. We have to choose what we're going to be trapped by. And for me, that seems quite a good thing to put my chips on.
One counter argument is that, well, if you have that, what you don't have are the huge rewards for innovation and inventions. So there are a lot of things that we complain about in the U.S., including income inequality, including the lack of a lot of the social service network that a lot of European countries have. But we are the country that makes Apple and Google and on and on and on and on. It seems that there's an upside to status seeking as well as downsides.
You're right in terms of accomplishment. There isn't the same incentive, perhaps, to go the extra mile that there might be in the UK and the US, I'd say. So I know that in some places of work, for instance, if your team are working on something, but it's 4 o'clock, they're going to go home. And so that can be a frustration for people coming from other countries who are used to perhaps, you know, people to stay there to really impress the boss or to just do that extra bit. I think for me, and from weighing up the, you know, the pros and cons, that there are always trade-offs. And the idea that you can have most of the people doing okay and fairly happy, well, no, you know, pretty happy, actually, that feels sort of worth it rather than a couple of tall poppies and everyone else in the gutter.
I think perhaps Danes have lower materialistic ambitions than in some countries. But in terms of having an interesting job, having a happy family, having a healthy hobby, and keeping fit, I think there is a lot of sort of expectations that people want to live up to.
So you've told us that Denmark and the other Scandinavian countries are relatively very high on social trust compared to the rest of the world. And you've told us that social trust drives happiness. We also know that social trust decreases when diversity increases. At least that's what a lot of literature that I've seen has to say. And we know that Denmark and other Scandinavian countries are, relative to other rich countries, the US and the UK in particular, are not very diverse. How much do you think the social trust in a place like Denmark is driven by some version of homogeneity? I've read that something like 85% of Danish citizens are not only born here, but are ethnically derived from Danes. How much of it is just a sort of comfort with belonging to a club that you belong to?
It's true that there is, in some of the Nordic countries, a high level of homogeneity. In Sweden, it's much less. They've been much more welcoming, right, to refugees and immigrants in the past years than for instance, Denmark and Norway. But then again, I mean, if you see the level of trust that have not declined
in Sweden yet, you're saying?
In Sweden, yeah. In Denmark, in Norway, in those countries that have accepted immigrants.
Has it been long enough, though, to know? Like with the refugees coming primarily from Syria and Iraq,
right,
that's relatively recent. So.
That's true.
And I also wonder, when I see those numbers, I wonder whether those refugees are part of the survey on social trust. Do we know?
They are.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, now it's refugees from Syria. But when I grew up, it was refugees from Vietnam. Then in the 90s, it was refugees from Bosnia. Then also in the 70s, it was not refugees, but migrant workers from Turkey. So we've had a lot of different waves of migrants. It's not a new phenomenon. And I don't see evidence that trust have fallen in the Nordic countries in that time.
I've read and heard from people who move here either as, you know, highly skilled workers or as refugees, that Denmark works great if you're Danish.
Yeah.
And that it's much harder. And granted, most countries are this way. But one particular complaint in Scandinavia is that even when you're being treated fairly and given opportunities, economic and educational opportunities and so on, it can be very, very hard to break into the society.
Yes. And that's what I hear also from expats living here, from my international friends, that it's very, very difficult to penetrate the social circles in Denmark and Scandinavia. So it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of time. It's a really, really tight-knit network. And it's also a very small country. And people still live down the block from people they know from they were in kindergarten together.
I believe that social, linguistic, ethnic, religious homogeneity probably is conducive to the social democratic model, but I don't believe that diversity is a barrier to it.
The economist Jeff Sachs again. The 2018 edition of the World Happiness Report focused on migration and happiness. One finding, he says, jumped out at his team of researchers.
People who move from a poor, unhappy, violence-filled country to a happy Nordic country become like the Nordic citizens in the country. They do carry some of the legacy of the country that they came from, but the adjustment is remarkably fast.
But of course, the adjustment depends on how welcoming a new country is.
It matters to go to a country where people are desirous and accepting of in-migration. I'm happy to say that despite what might appear to be the case in Trump land right now, Americans rank rather high on acceptability of migrants and still do, and I think that that's a wonderful thing. What I find fascinating about the social democracies, and Denmark is a good example of this, there's a very strong anti-migrant party in Denmark that is also very economically and socially left of center. So it's basically social democracy, but for the Danish people, not for migrants. Whereas in the United States, we tend to think, and in many other countries, we tend to think of anti-immigrant also as being right-wing. But Scandinavia has, yeah, we love our social democracy, but it's just for us.
It's also important to say here that, you know, Denmark, as you've seen, is by no means a utopia.
Mike Viking again.
First and foremost, it's important to note that the World Happiness Report, that is based on a national average. So you will have people above that average and below that average.
And the suicide rate here, for instance, is not wildly low. In fact, it's somewhere in the middle, correct?
Yeah, you would expect that the happiest countries in the world have a suicide rate of zero.
Although, truthfully, the data show that there is a paradox in that
right.
Suicide increases with well-being and
yeah.
prosperity. Yeah.
So if you look at the U.S. states, the individual states, the higher level of life satisfaction, the higher level of suicide rates.
The most compelling explanation of suicide I've ever heard about and discussed with the fellow who kind of promulgates it, because we don't really know that much about suicide because it's taboo, the research is very distant and so on. But he calls it the no one left to blame theory.
Right.
Which is that if you have problems in life, but you've got a toxic environment or a nasty government, you can always imagine that life will get a lot better. But if you're surrounded by happy, shiny people and you're not happy and shiny, it can be. So can you talk about that notion in a place that's so happy?
Yeah. So there is a term, the happiness suicide paradox, that talks about exactly that, that it might be more difficult to be unhappy in an otherwise happy society. If everybody around you feels that life is great, that are oh so happy, and you yourself feel unhappy, then that could create a stronger contrast and maybe you start to blame yourself. And more developed countries have, you know, reduced the reasons why we should be unhappy, have, you know, eliminated poverty, have eliminated, you know, lack of education. Then if I have all these opportunities, why am I still unhappy? We start to internalize that cause and blame ourselves.
Helen Russell, the British expat, has now lived in Denmark for 6 years. She and her husband had been trying unsuccessfully to have children back at home.
We had been trying to start a family for years, trying many different types of fertility treatment, but it never quite worked. And the only feedback I kept getting from various medical professionals was, oh, we don't know what it is, but you're quite stressed. But everyone in London is stressed. It's city life. It's what you do. So you just carry on. Life is busy. We just carry on.
Then you moved to Denmark. Mm-hmm. I understand now you have not one, but three children. So is Denmark also somehow a fertility engine? How did that work?
Well, I am now riddled with children. You are quite right. I have a litter. I think so. Full disclosure, child number one, Little Red. I found out I was pregnant 6 months after moving here. And so that is a result of being more relaxed. And that is an incredible thing. Also, the work-life balance is more conducive to being relaxed enough to conceive and also to having a family here. Women can have a career and a family because everything's shared a bit more equally between the sexes and there is this heavily subsidised childcare. I actually had IVF for my twins who were born last year. But again, it's cheaper to have IVF here than it certainly would have been in the UK. And interestingly, Denmark is one of the biggest exporters of sperm. So there's a lot of genetically Danish babies that'll be coming around the place in the next few years.
This suggests a nice study for some demographer out there to see whether all those genetically Danish babies will go spreading happiness around the globe. In the meantime, Helen Russell has also adapted to the Danish style of parenting.
I do leave my children outside to sleep.
Not overnight, presumably.
Not overnight, no. I mean, I might forget one day, but no. Just for nap times. And they do sleep really well because of the fresh air, and they're all bundled up in their old-fashioned prams, Mary Poppins style.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio...
The 9/11 Fund was fascinating because Congress authorized unlimited funds. Whatever Feinberg thinks is appropriate, fine with us. We don't know how to value these lives.
We speak with Kenneth Feinberg, the man America asks to decide how much money should go to the victims and survivors of tragedies.
Would you want Ken Feinberg's job?
I will tell you this. Looking at it now, he had one hell of a hard job.
See, that's not rocket science. The tough part, the debilitating part, is the emotion.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Stitcher or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, an online service that lets people send and receive money internationally. And their borderless account lets customers hold and convert multiple currencies at any time. More at TransferWise.com and the app. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
When something terrible happens, something truly terrible, a mass shooting or a terrorist attack, there is a man whose phone eventually will ring.
My name is Kenneth Feinberg. I'm a lawyer here in Washington, D.C.
Feinberg grew up near Boston in Brockton, Massachusetts.
Brockton High School graduate, University of Massachusetts graduate, New York University School of Law. And then I was asked by the chief judge of New York State to clerk for him.
This was in 1970. As Feinberg's career progressed, he got to know many of the chief judge's other former clerks.
One of whom was the very distinguished, eminent, Federal District Judge Jack B. Weinstein in Brooklyn.
One day, in 1984, Feinberg got a call from Judge Weinstein. By this time, Feinberg had put in time as a federal prosecutor and as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kennedy. Now he was in private practice. What did Judge Weinstein want?
Weinstein had assigned to him the Agent Orange litigation brought by Vietnam veterans against the chemical industry, Dow, Monsanto, alleging certain physical injuries and deaths attributable to inhaling or swimming in the herbicide Agent Orange while serving in Vietnam.
For those who don't recall or know, Agent Orange was an exfoliant meant to burn the shrubs off to give American soldiers an advantage, yeah?
That's right. So the Viet Cong couldn't hide and ambush American soldiers. Well, the Vietnam veterans came home with chloracne, with soft tissue sarcomas, with other cancers. And Judge Weinstein had that case, very complicated, very complex medical case. And on the eve of trial, he asked me, would I be willing to come to Brooklyn to mediate a settlement of that case and then design and administer a compensation program for eligible Vietnam veterans.
So Judge Weinstein knew that you very much admired him. Was that in any way putting his thumb on the scale in that case?
Yes, he put his thumb on the scale to get it settled. I don't think he put his thumb on the scale as to what the amount should be or whether the chemical industry had a better case than the Vietnam veterans. He put his thumb on the scale only in the sense that let's try and resolve this case rather than litigate the case and then appeals and 5 or 6 more years of uncertainty. he saw the necessity of trying to bring the litigation to closure. And he also saw that legally the veterans had a tough case. They may not win.
Were you aware of any previous programs or any previous settlements that were even close to similar to that in terms of scope and really magnitude?
No, unprecedented. Writing on a blank slate. So I accepted the assignment at the request, of course, of the court. And in 8 weeks, we settled that massive complex litigation. Once I did that, everybody started calling me.
The Agent Orange settlement didn't please everyone. In fact, there's barely ever a settlement like this that leaves everyone happy, because underlying each case is a tragedy that dollars cannot repair, a tragedy requiring a thankless and perhaps impossible calculus. But that's when Feinberg's phone rings.
It might be a governor, Hickenlooper in Colorado after the Aurora movie shootings. It might be a mayor, Menino, in Boston after the Boston Marathon bombings. It might be the president of the Virginia Tech University.
It's been happening far too often. The gun massacres at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, at the country music festival near the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas. When the call comes, Kenneth Feinberg sets aside his regular legal work and takes up the case, usually working pro bono. I know every case is different. There's a different set of victims. There's a different motivation. There's a different pool of money. There's a different public sentiment. Walk us through how you get involved, how you assess the landscape, and then how you begin to make it happen.
So on the agenda, one, somebody initiates it. Not me. I get the call to design it. Somebody initiates it. Then the very next question you have to ask, how much money do you have to distribute? That drives everything. Until you know whether you've got $1 billion, $5 billion, $20 billion, $3 million, $8 million, there's nothing to plan. You can't decide and design a program until you know how much money there is that you're going to allocate to victims. Then you ask, based on the amount of money, who's eligible? The dead? The physically injured? What about those who didn't suffer any physical injury but are now so mentally incapacitated they can't get out of bed? Are they eligible? Then you have to ask, very important, what is the methodology that will be used to calculate how much goes to each individual? Do we base it on our tort system? If somebody gets hit by an automobile or falls off a ladder, that system? Does one size fit all? All lives are equal? Everybody gets the same? You've got to decide what methodology will be used. And then after you've got eligibility and methodology decided, what proof does a victim, alleged, have to submit to me to corroborate the claim? And then finally, do you want to give every eligible victim or their family, at their option, an opportunity to be heard, to come in and talk with me? Once I get that call, those are the issues that have to be addressed.
In the time between the event itself and you getting the call, let's say it's the Vegas shooting or it's the Orlando shooting, what are you thinking? Are you waiting for the call? Are you thinking about that event? Are you assessing in any way?
I'm not waiting for the call. I hope the call won't come. And if it does come, I hope that it will come later rather than earlier. The more time that goes by after a tragedy, you hope there'll be a dampening of the emotion of the survivors and the victims. Emotional trauma is the single biggest handicap, obstacle, to successful implementation of these programs.
You've said in the past that the single, maybe most common heartache of 9/11 survivors, victims' families, was the lack of a body. Yes?
Yes.
Did that surprise you?
It surprised me the depth of the emotional angst when mothers and fathers would come to see me and say, you know, Mr. Feinberg, you're offering me $4 million, and they haven't even found my daughter's body, and probably never will. That raises the emotional stakes of a hearing, of a give and take, and makes it all that much more difficult to talk in the cold world of dollars and cents.
One of your most unusual settlements was after the 2008 financial crisis, when the government essentially took over a number of firms, and you were called in to set the limits on their top executives' compensation.
Congress bailed out corporate America after the 2008-09 financial crisis in order to prevent Bank of America or GM or Chrysler or Citibank, AIG, from going under. Taxpayer money propped up the private American business economic system. Congress passed a law, and the law said, well, now that we've protected these companies and bailed them out from bankruptcy, we are now a creditor. And until the companies pay us back with interest, we will appoint the Treasury Department to fix corporate pay, the annual compensation of private corporate officials.
And they thought, what kind of guy could we get?
Populist revenge.
Yeah.
Secretary of the Treasury called me up and said, we're at Treasury. We don't want to be in this business setting private corporate pay. What would Alexander Hamilton say? So this was my job for 16 months, to set individual corporate packages of compensation for the top 25 officials in the seven companies that receive the most taxpayer bailout assistance.
Yeah. And what kind of blowback did you get from them?
Tremendous blowback. I did not realize how emotional this would get. Corporate officials, if I go to them and say, you are making $5 million a year, now I'm going to cut it back to $1 million. I waited for them to say, oh, that means I'll have to sell a third car. I'll have to get rid of our estate on Long Island at the beach. I won't be able to send my kids to Exeter and Andover. That's what I expected. I was wrong. Very emotional. Because these corporate officials viewed their compensation as the sole barometer of self-worth.
And that surprised you?
Surprised me. It was as emotional as 9/11. Mr. Feinberg, if you cut my pay by 90 or 80%, how dare you? I have worked for 25 years for this company. I have given it my sweat and my blood and all that I could. And now you have made me worthless in my own eyes.
What did you think of that argument? Did you find validity in it or no?
I found validity in the legitimacy and good faith emotion that they exhibited. But with all due respect, that was not a rationale for me to say I feel bad for you and therefore I won't cut your pay. Congress passed a law. I was frankly astounded at the emotional mirror of self-worth that was reflected in what your check says every week. What about the church and your role on Sundays at the church? What about your three children and how well they're being raised? What about the loving family that you've got? Nope. Nope.
There is, of course, a big difference between a government clawback from corporate executives and distributing money to the victims and survivors of a mass shooting or a terrorist attack. And in most of the latter cases, the funds are coming not from an institution or government, but from public donations. The One Orlando Fund, for instance, was set up to help victims of the Pulse nightclub shooting, in which 49 people were killed and dozens injured. The fund received more than $31 million in donations. Of that, Feinberg distributed more than $17 million to the families of the people who were murdered. The victims who spent time in a hospital but survived got between $69,000 and $321,000. And people who were in the nightclub but weren't hospitalized got a bit more than $26,000 each. When it comes to putting a price on human life and suffering, Feinberg is hardly reinventing the wheel.
There are actually lots of different ways to do it.
That's W. Kip Viscusi.
I'm an economist, and I'm a professor at Vanderbilt University.
Viscusi's work has focused on a widely used metric called the value of a statistical life.
The value of statistical life refers to how much it's worth to prevent one expected death.
Some people, especially if it's their own death they're trying to prevent, would put that number at infinity.
Everybody who thinks that life should have an infinite value should instead ask themselves the question, how much would you pay for a car that's, you know, safer but by a trivial amount? And most people are not willing to pay an unlimited amount of money for this slightly safer car.
There's another complication to statistically valuing a life, an even harder problem to solve.
Lots of people say that even placing any dollar number on life devalues life. So we shouldn't be doing it at all. But as a routine practice, government agencies have to make decisions. So either implicitly or explicitly, they're going to be valuing life, and we want them to use the right numbers.
Okay, so what are the right numbers? How do you get there? Let's start with the way it used to be.
So it used to be the government agencies, such as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, did not want to explicitly say that they're placing a value on life. So instead, they called it the cost of death. Well, the cost of death figures only capture the income lost to survivors. They don't capture how much you value your own life and how much you value staying alive. So what you really want to know is how much are people willing to pay and how much is society willing to pay to prevent the risk of one expected death. And the way I've looked at it is by examining how much workers require in terms of compensation to face extra risks of death on the job. And if you do that, you come up with a number in current dollars of about $10 million.
In a perfect world, the compensation for risky work would inevitably price in that risk. But as Viscusi explains, the world is far from perfect.
So what I've found is that whether you get paid or not depends on, in part on who you are. So immigrant workers, particularly Mexican immigrants who are not fluent in English, work on jobs that are 50% riskier than the average job, and they don't get extra pay for the risk. So these are the areas where we need more government regulation and more vigorous enforcement of the regulatory standards. I would not place a lower value on their lives simply because they have fewer opportunities. If you gave them these opportunities, they would have different values.
Viscusi's calculations are, well, calculated, even rational, perhaps. The problem is that rationality often dissipates once a terrible thing happens. When people are hurt or killed by a company's product and there's a lawsuit.
I've done studies with mock jurors, hundreds of mock jurors, where I presented them with different case scenarios. And in some case scenarios, the companies didn't place a value on life at all. Other scenarios, the company placed a value based on the lost earnings. Another variant was the company placed a value on life based on the government's value of statistical life. What I found is that you get a seemingly perverse result, which is that if the companies value lives more, let's say they value lives at $5 million or $7 million instead of a few hundred thousand dollars, jurors want to send companies a signal that they disapprove of what the company's done. So they want to punish them with an award that exceeds whatever dollar number the company used. So if the company used a number of $300,000, then punishing them $1 million would send them a price signal. But if they valued life at $5 million, you have to punish them with a penalty of $10 million in order to let them know that they've undervalued life.
And there's another complication. Are all lives valued equally?
This is a capitalist society.
Ken Feinberg again.
Money has always been the vehicle to lift up the innocent or the victim. And that is something that is American. Gee, you're giving different amounts to different individuals. That doesn't sound like very American. It is very American If somebody gets hit by an automobile or falls off a ladder, the stockbroker and the banker get more than the waiter, the busboy, or the fireman. That's the American capitalist system, and that's the role of money in trying to temper the unfortunate.
Coming up after the break, that system gets put to the test after the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
I was angry. I was very angry. Yet, at the same time, I didn't want to bite the hand that would feed me.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Abacus, a real-time expense reporting software designed to reimburse team members, reconcile corporate cards, and implement expense policies without expense reports. More information at abacus.com/freak.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Kenneth Feinberg is a lawyer in private practice in Washington, D.C.
And I have the task, after certain tragedies, of trying to calculate what amount of public or private compensation should be allocated to particular victims.
If you've heard of Feinberg before today, it's likely because one of the tragedies he worked on was the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He sought out that job.
That's correct. Once the legislation was passed by Congress and signed by President Bush saying there would be a fund,
yeah,
I suggested to both Senator Kennedy and Senator Chuck Hagel, a good friend of mine from Nebraska, Republican, I'd be interested. Well, that's all it took. They together contacted John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, the President, Bush, and I got the job.
This job was, for many reasons, different from any other. The scope of the tragedy, the political, economic, and emotional tensions, and perhaps most distinctively, the source of the settlement money.
The 9/11 fund was fascinating because Congress authorized unlimited funds. Whatever Feinberg thinks is appropriate, fine with us. We don't know how to value these lives. And in that program, I spent taxpayer money, $7.1 billion. I thought that the Congress would hang me. And instead, the Congress was very, very satisfied.
There were a lot of things about the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund that were unique. The airlines and other industries, for instance, didn't contribute 1 cent. The legislation was written essentially to protect the airline industries and other industries, maybe insurance firms, from going out of business.
It basically, although the program was voluntary, it encouraged all victims who lost loved ones in the World Trade Center, the airlines, the Pentagon, to divert themselves out of the legal system, come in for a special award, and promise on a signed piece of paper, I will not sue. If you're giving immunity, in effect, to the airlines, who can't be sued for negligence, or Boeing, the cockpit door wasn't secure, the security system was negligently installed. If you're giving them sort of immunity from suit, well, what about the victims who paid the price? Congress decided we better balance it. We will make it very difficult to sue the airlines or the World Trade Center, but at the same time, we'll make it very easy for victims to get compensated without suing. So that was the balance that was struck. That meant, the minute I saw that voluntary applicants have to sign a paper, I will not sue. Well, that means everybody who filed a claim has to receive a different amount of money. A stockbroker or a banker or a high-priced lawyer or accountant, their survivors expect more from the 9/11 fund in return for a promise not to sue than the waiter, the busboy, the fireman, the cop, the soldier. The minute you take a program with public money and join the litigation at the hip of the program, everybody's getting a different amount, and that causes tremendous divisiveness.
But I believe it was Senator Kennedy who said to you, listen, you need to understand that a life is a life, and that while you do need to recompense more in some cases, can you talk about that balance you tried to strike?
Of course. Senator Kennedy said flat out, privately, now can. This is all taxpayer money coming out of the U.S. Treasury. Make sure that 90% of that money doesn't go to 10% of the victims. That will be a real mistake. So what I did under the statute, I had discretion. And I could say to a stockbroker's widow, you know, if you run the numbers, purely the calculation of lost earnings, your husband, over a lifetime, after taxes, etc., would have made $21 million. Well, this fund was not designed. Congress never intended to give you $21 million. So I'm exercising my discretion under the statute, and I'm going to reduce it to $6 million. Now, there are very, very few people even getting $6 million. But based on the data and what your husband was earning and what he was likely projected to earn, you're going to be a high-end compensated individual, whereas the waiter or the busboy might have had lifetime earnings after taxes of $800,000. I'm going to raise you, in my discretion, closer not to $2 million, but closer to the median of about $1.5 million. And that way, exactly as you point out, I managed exercising my valid discretion to narrow the gap between the rich and the poor.
Did you hear a lot of complaints from the families of the highest earners?
Some. A few sued. They went to federal court, claiming that I was violating the statute by not giving them their full economic lost wage or earnings.
They sued within the corridor of the settlement, having agreed to the settlement?
No, so, they didn't accept the settlement. I said, I'll give you $6 million instead of $21 million or $24 million. And they said, you're violating the statutory language. They went to court. They all settled their cases 5 years later. There was never a trial. And people ask me all the time, did they get more or less? Well, some may have got more, some may have got less.
Hard for you to know.
Hard to know. It's confidential. But don't forget, those families lived with this for 5 years and relived it and relived the tragedy. And at the end of the day, whatever they got, 25% of it went to their lawyers.
It strikes me that you have approached this very much as a mediator and a lawyer, meaning you're an advocate for a resolution. And as a result of that, you purposely divorce yourself a little bit from some of the moral and ethical components.
A widow came to me so upset I thought she might collapse in my office. She was in sobbing, and she said, Mr. Feinberg, I lost my husband. He was a fireman at the World Trade Center, and he left me with our three children, 6, 4, and 2. He was Mr. Mom. He cooked all our meals. I will never be the same no matter how much money you provide me. She leaves. We helped her out. The next day, I get a telephone call from a lawyer in Queens. Mr. Feinberg, you know the woman you met with the three children, 6, 4, and 2, Mr. Mom? I go, yes, tragic. He said, I got to tell you, she doesn't know that her husband, Mr. Mom, has two other children by his girlfriend in Queens, 5 and 3. And I'm telling you this because I represent the girlfriend. And when you cut your check from the 9/11 fund, there are not three surviving children. There are 5 surviving children. But I'm sure you'll do the right thing. Click. He hangs up. Well, do you tell her? Do you tell her about the other children and her husband leading a double life? Those are the quandaries, you see, way beyond calculating dollars and cents. My law degree isn't much help in a situation like that. Maybe a divinity degree or a degree in psychiatry. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Well, I didn't tell her. We cut one check to her and the three children. Mm-hmm. And without her knowledge, we did a separate calculation and cut a check to the girlfriend as the guardian of the two children.
Do you feel it's a more complicated calculation to do the kind of calculations that economists like Kip Viscusi do that try to put a price on, among other things, public goods, right? Clean air and water and so on. Do you think that's inherently a much more...
Oh, much more difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, What I do in all of these programs is not rocket science. The tough part, the debilitating part, is the emotion. The stories you hear, you wouldn't believe. Lady comes to see me, 24 years old, sobbing. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my husband. He was a firefighter, and he died at the World Trade Center. And he left me with our two children, 6 and 4. Now, when you cut the check from the 9/11 fund, I'm going to get $2.4 million tax-free. I want it in 30 days. Mrs. Jones, why do you need the money in 30 days? This is public money. The Treasury has to do its due diligence. It might be 90 days. You'll get your money. I want it in 30 days. Why? I'll tell you why, Mr. Feinberg. I have terminal cancer. I have 8 weeks to live. My husband was going to take care of our two children. Now they're going to be orphans. Now I've got to get this money while I still have my faculties. I've got to set up a trust, get a guardian, make sure they'll be provided for. I don't have much time. You got to help me. Well, we ran down to the Treasury. We accelerated the program. We got her the check. 6 weeks later, she died.
Did you try in the beginning to be more empathic, perhaps, than you realized was a good idea?
Yes, and I make mistakes. You see, you make mistakes and you learn your lesson. I remember one 83-year-old man came to see me after 9/11. He said, I lost my son. Mr. Feinberg, a father should never bury a son. I'll never be the same. Doesn't matter how much money you give me. I made the mistake of saying to this very nice man, this is terrible. I know how you feel. He looked at me. Nice man. Tears. Mr. Feinberg, don't ever tell people like me that you know how I feel. You have no idea how I feel. You have a tough job, but those words ring hollow. They're pretentious. They're robotic. Well, I'll never do that again.
I was angry. I was very angry. Yet, at the same time, I didn't want to bite the hand that would feed me.
That is Charles Wolfe, whose wife, Catherine, died on 9/11. He is an Amway distributor. Catherine worked with him on that business and just started a new job as an executive assistant in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. We asked our friend Anna Sale, host of the Death, Sex, and Money podcast, to talk with Wolf about his experience with Ken Feinberg and the 9/11 Fund.
Congress takes action. Ultimately, there is one person, one man, whose job it is to be the person to give you an answer on what of this fund, this money from the government, what will be your share because of your loss?
No, that's not the way it worked. Real simply, this did not have a fixed amount of money allocated to it. He had the entire United States Treasury at his disposal. It was not based on how much of this money were you going to get. They made it exactly like you would happen for a wrongful death lawsuit. They calculated it based on lost future earnings and pain and suffering.
Did that feel like, if he tells me he's calculating, I feel like there could be more potential for frustration if you feel like he's underestimating.
I understood that. So my mind was, I needed to prove how much Catherine was worth based on her current income, what her absence in our business would result in, and hopefully that everything would work out.
And when you say had to prove, are you sitting with spreadsheets and doing the numbers yourself?
A lot of it, yeah. I'm gathering information. I'm gathering past information. I'm gathering data.
Yeah.
Because the issue was the non-economic damages, the pain and suffering.
What was that worth? That was the question.
Yeah, exactly. He had picked a number at that time that was 27 years old.
Based on a 27-year-old formula.
Correct. And with no adjustments or anything. Because I learned that lawyers like to work on precedents. They don't like to probe new ground.
Did you feel like he knew how to communicate with people who were in deep grief?
No, not at that time. No. So I had to, shall we see, be very diplomatic about it. I had to say things in a certain way. But I'd already done my homework. I knew the ins and outs of the whole thing. And I'm making sure that I attack his policies and rules, not him personally. I do remember, though, because at this point, you don't know who to trust or who not to trust. And I remember, because I went after him several times. And he says, Charles, in his Boston accent, he says, Charles, I've heard this all before, but I've never heard it said so eloquently. I'm like, is he giving me BS? Is he trying to placate me? Is he trying to soften me? Is he, well, what's going on here? And as he walked out of the room afterwards, I mean, he was just walking by me like this. I says, you picked the wrong benchmark.
I don't know if you use the word closure when you're thinking about your own grief, but
I just had a dream about her last night. Closure might be for something like you go through in a divorce. And you remember that old song, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair?
Yeah.
Okay.
I felt that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. You know, that might be closure. All right. It's done. That's closure. No, there's no closure in this. What you do is you move on in your life. But when there's somebody that you've loved, deeply loved, does that love ever go away?
Would you want Ken Feinberg's job?
I will tell you this, looking at it now, he had one hell of a hard job. He and I had breakfast together in 08. He says, Charles, he says, my lawyer training taught me how to deal with other lawyers. It didn't teach me how to deal with grieving widows 6 weeks after they lost their husbands. I says, I get that. He had to learn. People have their spouses taken, their siblings taken, their parents taken. See, this is the thing. Unless you've been through this, there were times that I just wanted to be with her. I actually never thought of committing suicide, but I knew that I wanted to be dead so I could be with her. When you get to that level, it's about having something in return. It's about something. Who can value a person's life? So what they did is they gave us what they would have made in the future, the best estimation they could. That's the way it was. I still think that's a fair way to do it.
I'll defend the 9/11 Compensation Fund to my grave. I think it did exactly what the American people wanted to show the world. We take care of our own. They wanted to demonstrate their sense of community with the victims. So I think it was the right thing to do. But I think the 9/11 Fund better studied in a history class, not a law school class. You will never see another 9/11 Fund, I do not believe. Nor should you.
Because why?
Because you're taking public money.
What if there's an event that necessitates?
There's an event every day that necessitates.
There's this word that I'm sure you've heard a million times. The word is closure. Does it exist?
No. I hear that all the time. I mean, I... You know, you hear this argument, here's a check for $2 million. It will bring you some small closure from the incident and the grief. Dollars don't do that. They're a hollow substitute, I can tell you, for loss.
Thanks to Kenneth Feinberg for speaking with us today. If you want to learn more about his settlement work, he's written two books, What is Life Worth? And Who Gets What? Thanks also to Charles Wolfe, Anna Sale, and Kip Viscusi. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or on Stitcher. And you can always subscribe and listen to the latest 3 months of episodes on any podcast platform.